So hello, everyone.
Welcome
to our Integral Spiritual Experience Looking Forward to Dialogue. And this is Mark Goffney here with former Swami Durgananda, a.k.a. known presently as Sally Kempton, who's a well-known spiritual teacher, author, writes a monthly beautiful column in Yoga Journal, and is a good friend, and Lama Surya Das, a great teacher of Tibetan Buddhism and really at the forefront of the entire integration of Western thinking and, you know, profound, authentic, you know, real, you know, deep practice Buddhism and particularly Tibetan Buddhism, and a friend that I met a number of years ago and in a brief meeting and have had the pleasure of reconnecting with. And so this is the bad joke of a rabbi, a swami, and a lama meet in a bar. And what happens? So it's delightful to be here. And what I thought I might do is just introduce the topic and then, you know, turn it over to you to chat about a little bit, Surya, and to Sally. Sally and I actually just finished a dialogue with our mutual friend of all of us, of Ken Wilber, on unique self. And unique self is the topic of the first Integral Spiritual Experience, where Surya Das will be giving a major keynote address, you know, on Friday night. And just to talk a little bit about what we mean by unique self, to introduce it, perhaps through a Hasidic or Kabbalistic text, just to open up the conversation, and then we'll open in free flow, free form from there. So when we talk about unique self, we're not talking about the level of uniqueness, right, the level of specialness that the Course of Miracles is devoted to telling you, give up your specialness. Or you walk into virtually any Buddhist context in the United States, whether it's a Theravadan context or a Mahayana context or even a kind of Vajrayana context, where people say, you know, give up your story. You know, step in, give up your story. That's not what we're talking about when we're talking about unique self. Right? We clearly recognize the need to give up your story, to deconstruct the reified artificial self, right, to reject specialness at an egoic level of consciousness. At the same time, it was a very, very strong idea, which I've, you know, spent much of my life in a Kabbalistic Hasidic context in my lineage, which roughly translated, I've called either soul prince or unique self. It appears in the Sufi lineage as, you know, the pearl beyond price. Ken has suggested that in Tibetan Buddhism, it's the eternal drop. You know, Surya will talk to us about that. I have no way of actually, you know, saying anything intelligent about that. But what it means in the Hebrew and in the Sufi lineage is that after the void, that is after we've gone through ego death, which is, of course, a continual process, right, when we emerge, as it were, on the other side, and talking very proverbially, very kind of in broad sweeping terms, we don't stay, right, in the void or even in the spaciousness of the void, or even in the expansive fullness of shunyata or ayin, right, in Kabbalah. But when we emerge into this place in which we fall into or emerge into our uniqueness, right, our infinite uniqueness, the infinite face of the divine refracted through the unique prism, which is that particular person, that unique perspective that's not shared, that never was and never will be. And that unique self is precisely what calls us, what demands us, right, to be in the world expressing divinity as God's unique verbs, unique, you know, nouns, unique dangling modifiers. That's the sense of unique self that we're talking about. And it's that sense that, you know, at least in some readings, some have claimed, right, is expressed at least elliptically, right, in the 10th Oxfording picture, right, at the end of those that gorgeous, you know, Buddhist expression of enlightenment, as, you know, one returns to the marketplace, one returns through the prism of one's unique self. So that's kind of the frame of our conversation. And just to talk about what that means, unique self, no self, what do they have to do with each other, how do they relate to each other, and how might this idea play, right, in our conversation as we try and evolve spirituality forward, right, in the next millennium. So that's introduction. Surya, let me toss it over to you and just, you know, any take us in any direction which that might have evoked in you.
Well, that was a very beautiful outline, so thank you. And very unique also, if I may teasingly say so. In your inimitable manner. Thank you, Mark. First of all, it's a pleasure to be here with you and Sally. Really a pleasure. And to talk about this. The word self is not the funnest word in the Buddhist tradition. But let me clarify a few things. In Buddhism, we think about the relative self, the healthy individuated self that knows how to take care of ourselves and distinguish between self and other in a way that a child, a baby can't, an infant can't, or some mentally ill people can't. So the healthy individuated self with a small s, the ego-centric, conceptual, individual self, and on the other hand, the transpersonal being, what we call the Buddha nature, Tathagatagarbha, the great, the ultimate sphere, what Ken was calling in translation, the great drop, particularly Chenpo in Tibetan, the ultimate sphere. So the individual self with a small s, from Buddhist point of view, is like a bubble in the infinite sea, the great drop. And the word drop is interesting because it represents the infinite in the finite, as the entire sea of being is in each bubble. And we don't have to slay, kill, or destroy that ego, that bubble, just see through it in order to find our place in the totality, the great sphere, the ultimate sphere, Tivoli Chenpo, what Ken Wilber, the brilliant theoretician and integral thinker, calls the great drop. And this is like the sphere of God or any of those other synonyms that the good rabbi used. And so we shouldn't get confused. For example, even with the 10 ox herding pictures, which maybe not everybody's familiar with, but actually all 10 are expressions of the Supreme Self. And the 10th one is just the ultimate aspect that includes them all. So if you recognize the unity and diversity, each step on the path is the total path. As St. Teresa, St. Catherine of Siena once said, every step of the way to heaven is heaven. So it's not just the goal, it's also the fundament, it's the ground, it's the starting point, the totality, the ultimate sphere, as the sea includes every drop. And the drop, the individual self or soul, doesn't have to go anywhere to return to its rightful place within one, beyond the dualistic polarities like oneness and noneness or no self. So we're more interested in unselfishness and selflessness rather than absolute distinctions or concepts such as no self, which are opposed in the bifurcating intellect, the dualistic thinking, as one or many or self or no self. But it's really, the small self is a reflection of the supreme self, as from my Jewish background, I have a slight feeling that each of our souls is considered like a spark of God. And in fact, that the whole fire, divine fire, is in each of those sparks.
That's a beautiful distinction.
It is beautiful.
You know, Surya, between, and let me, with this, turn it over to you, Sally, right, between, you know, talking about no self as a kind of intellectual construct and unselfishness, you know, and that kind of reframing, you know, you can actually feel it, you know, not just in your mind and your heart, but you can actually feel it in your body, you know, that move, which I think, you know, everyone can really just deeply open and appreciate. So, Sally, where are you going to take us here?
Well, I thought I would mention the Hindu perspective, which is not really that dissimilar from what Surya was talking about. You know, as you know, even though Hinduism and Buddhism are in, if you want to get into the bifurcating aspect of different traditions, there's a long, centuries-long discussion about whether there is such a thing as a self. In the Hindu tradition, the word for self is Atman, and the Hindus make this basic distinction between the individual self, the Jivatman, and the great self, the Paramatman. It's exactly the same one that Surya is speaking about, and with the same understanding that the wholeness, the great self, the Paramatman, is contained in the Jivatman, just as the Jivatman is contained in the Paramatman. And it is the great paradox that we come to recognize when we get to the point that where we give up our attachment to the kind of hierarchies of the spiritual distinctions of where we are in the path, of what our level is, of, you know, of what the truth is, and, you know, and we actually can begin to relax into the fact that God dwells within you as you, as my teacher used to say, that God dwells within you, you know, as your awareness, as your consciousness, but also as your personal self. And you know, so as Surya beautifully said, when we stop being selfish, that is, when we stop, you know, one of the ways you describe this is when we stop being attached to ourselves as the doers of our actions and the thinkers of our thoughts, then the natural expression of godness flows through us with essentially no problem, even though personality will remain, you know. And I've always found that the big confusion that spiritual students have about enlightened states is that for enlightened people, personality does not remain. You know, we have the idea that when you're enlightened, or let me not use that word, when you're being your
let's not use that word, enlightenment.
Not use that word. Confusing word. But, you know, when we're being our God self, our walking expression of God self, that, you know, that there's none of the quirkiness of culture or, you know, temperament. And, in fact, the apparently enlightened beings that I've known, and I would say including any of us, all of us in our moments of connection to the deep self, we find that the personality, you know, that expresses itself actually with a great deal more freedom. And, you know, and that's the great paradox of the unique self, that it can be so completely personal, and yet there is not that sense of confinement to the personality or attachment to the personality.
Okay, no, that was just really, really helpful, and thank you. So I want to try and push into this a little bit and see if we, you know, and just open up a couple of questions and see if we can't kind of, you know, make this really clear, you know, for our listeners, and maybe through their grace, you know, for myself and for ourselves. So there's one or two things we could be saying here, and there's one or two ways to hear this conversation, you know, and I want to just try and maybe outline both of them just in a moment. One is, you know, the kind of understanding the drop of the sea in the great ocean, which, you know, appears in, you know, in the Zohar and Levi Isaac of Berdichev, you know, and in all the great Sufi teachings and the Buddhist teachings and the, you know, this is really where perennial philosophy and the Hindu teachings, right, the drop is part of the ocean. And in that sense, the drop, when the drop merges with the ocean, the drop loses its distinctness. Right? That's one kind of understanding. And the reason that's an important understanding, and the reason we even care about this at all, like why bother talking about this, you know, on a Monday afternoon, like, you know, we're all busy, is because, well, what kind of instruction do we give to ourselves, you know, to our students, to our friends, right? Is the way to be part of the great one, right? Is it to move beyond the quirks of personality? Clearly, there's a small self needs to be left behind. You know, that's very clear. And the great Theravadin teachings really, really focused on how you really show the discontinuity and the disillusionment of that small self. But then where do we go? And after we've entered the void, right, after we've gone through the ego death, right, is it that the drop becomes part of the ocean, right? And when we're reanimated, as it were, as part of the ocean, the personality kind of expresses itself, you know, much more freely and beautifully. But ultimately, you know, that's a transient, you know, passing phenomena. But who we really are, our essence, is that eternal essence. Or everything we just said with one addition, which is it's not just the personality, right? But there's a distinction maybe between the personality, which we might want to leave lots of behind, and the unique self, that is to say, the unique contours of something which is far more essential in us. And that when we actually go to the transpersonal, we go to personal plus, not personal minus. And maybe the way to say it, you know, just extrapolating out of a kind of Sufi and Kabbalistic text, the way they play with it, or they don't use these words, is it's kind of what I call a puzzle piece theory of enlightenment. That is to say, you think you got to round the edges of your puzzle piece in order to become one with the one, right? But actually, it's only your singularity that brings you to that single place. It's through actually accentuating the unique curves of your puzzle piece nature, leaving behind the false curves, leaving behind the personality, but accentuating that unique, you know, DNA code of reality that's you, that, you know, it's only that process that allows you to fit in as a puzzle piece into the great puzzle. And that when Eddington talks about the seamless code of the universe, right, it's seamless, but it's not featureless, right? And even at the highest level, those features remain. And that's a very different, the reason that's an important conversation is because it's a very different path for the seeker, right? What am I trying to do, right? On the one hand, I want to nullify my ego structure, right? After I've developed a healthy ego, right, there's a dimension of my ego I want to nullify, you know, but then what happens next? Do I then want to reclaim at the higher level the pearl beyond price? Or do I really want to let that go right, and actually just have this animated sense of my being part of a larger whole, and the personality will fall and play as it needs to. And those are two very different paths. And of course, we're not talking about which one's right or wrong, right? You know, we're not in that place at all, but we're just trying to feel into, you know, those paths and how in this translineage conversation we might be able to clarify them. Does that help as a question? That's all a big question mark.
Can I just make one semantic point here?
Please.
I think we need to define the word personality here because I believe you're using personality in the sense of the, let's say, neurotic personality or the, and actually I was, and I think we can also use personality to mean actually the features of our individual essence. You know, in other words, if we say that the qualities of God expressed in an individual, you know, might include wisdom and strength and love.
Right.
Yet these, that wisdom and strength and love would look different in you, you know.
Right. I completely hear you. You're absolutely right. We were using, thank you for being precise about that, Swami. We were using personality differently. Right? That is, I was using personality more in the classical way it's used in modern Buddhist literature, saying that the small self, and you were using it something closer to a pearl beyond price unique self.
Right.
Right. So let's agree before we go forward and turn it over to Surya how we want to use it. I bow to whatever your choice is.
First of all, I wouldn't want to get lost in the ocean of metaphors and similes, you know, the drop and the ocean and the pearl and the price and
puzzle.
So on and the nomenclature and the puzzle and so on and path. But I think that when we talk about who we really are, which is the issue of self and the nature of self and other and one's relation to God and place in the universe, and as Buddhism calls it, anatta, no separate individual permanent self, and I want to stress that again, not just no self, no separate permanent individual self, out of a process. So there is a relative separate self, you and me, and when I'm hungry, if you eat, it doesn't necessarily nourish my body. The notion of separation and diversity. So we have to have that discriminating awareness at the same time as we can have a unitary awareness of the fact that all living things need nourishment or whatever, or we're all interconnected in one single web. Inseparable doesn't necessarily mean oneness. There's room for unity and diversity, and those are not contradictions. And that's why we're talking in this way. Mark, you were saying you were raising the question about, you know, does the individual seeker or wayfarer or whatever, you know, does the bubble return to the sea or whatever? That's why I like the image of the bubble in the sea, which I think I borrowed from Kabir, the Indian saint who combined Sufism and Hinduism in his mysticism. And I recommend his books and poems to anybody, Kabir, especially Bly's translations, but there are many. And it's important to recognize that the bubble doesn't have to return to sea, that we don't have to really return to God, just recognize what we've always been part and parcel of. So even the word union or unity becomes a false concept, leading us to pushing it away from ourselves by thinking we're separate and we have to gain union. That's why union, which is the real meaning of the word yoga, and there are various kinds of yogas, means to union with God or union with the highest. In the Tibetan language, it's naljor, which means reunion with the natural state. So it's not just union of that which is separate. It's reunion. It's like coming back to whom what you truly are. And I think that's important. So in that way, we can have a gradual path. For example, in Buddhism, there's been a lot of discussion over 2,000 years. It's an old tradition about gradual enlightenment and sudden enlightenment and practices that gradually help open your heart and be less selfish and awaken the wisdom in your mind and so on, as well as the sudden enlightenment that is in the atemporal time of nowness that's always here. So we can be climbing up the spiritual path or mountain as if from below while swooping down from above,
right,
with the absolute, the bigger picture at the same time, that everything is already perfect and complete, a lawful unfolding as it is. And in that sense, it's reunion with the natural state or the original innocence and perfection, not just union of that which is separate. And we try, the seeker, the wayfarer, the separate individual self or personality tries to reach the great state of oneness. So we don't make oneness or shunyata, great emptiness, or any of these goals into pie in the sky that's far away from us. Because we may feel far from it, whatever we call it, but I assure you, it is never far from us.
Right.
Amen. Amen. Amen.